This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
What was Mr. Markell doing when you pulled up behind him?
He was on the phone.
All right, still seated in the driver's seat of his vehicle?
Yes, ma'am.
And what happened once you pulled into his driveway?
As soon as I pulled in, Garcia jumped off. Jumped out of the car and went around. Not around, but in front of the car.
Mm-hmm.
Right behind his car and in front of the car I was driving. Went to the driver's side and shot him.
He shot Mr. Markell?
Yes, ma'am.
That's Luis Rivera, wearing a blue prison-issue jumpsuit, seated on the stand, testifying in a crowded courtroom in Tallahassee, Florida. And he's casually describing how he says his best friend, Sigfredo Garcia, walked up to 42-year-old Dan Markell's car and shot him through the closed driver's side window, twice in the head. Although during his testimony, Lewis claims that he and Sigfredo will always be friends, he's testifying against him in Sigfredo's murder trial, a trial in which Sigfredo's longtime on-again, off-again girlfriend, Catherine Katie Magbanawa, is also a defendant. In episode 93, part one, I covered Dan's murder, as well as the first part of this trial. I had to divide this up into two episodes because, quite honestly, there is so much information and details involved in this case that I want to make sure I cover all of the important parts and not worry about fitting it all into one episode. Just to recap what we learned in the first episode and who the main people are in this case, Dan Markell, the victim, had gone through a tumultuous divorce with his ex-wife, Wendy Adelson. According to motions they filed against each other and emails admitted into evidence, Wendy and her mom, Donna Adelson, wanted Wendy to move to South Florida with the kids to be closer to the rest of her family. That request was denied by the judge. There was also a motion right before he died that Dan had filed accusing Donna, Wendy's mom, of trash-talking him to their kids. He had asked the judge to impose supervised visits with Donna and the kids, but before that could be ruled upon, Dan was killed. Now here's the prosecution's theory. They believe that the Adelson family, namely Donna and Wendy's brother Charlie, were behind the plot to kill Dan. At the time of Dan's death, Charlie was dating Catherine, or Katie, as you'll hear her be referred to as, and prosecutors believe that Charlie enlisted Catherine's help in doing so. Catherine then turned to the father of her children, whom she had separated from at the time, Sigfredo Garcia, and hired him to do it. Sigfredo then asked his best friend, Luis Rivera, to help. Sigfredo Garcia, Luis Rivera, and Catherine Magbanawa have all been charged in the case. Luis confessed and pleaded guilty and is now testifying in the trial against Sigfredo and Catherine. Meanwhile, no one from the Adelson family, not Charlie nor Donna, have been arrested. So here we are with part two. If you haven't yet listened to part one, please do so now before continuing on. In part two, we're going to cover more of what you just heard in the very beginning of this episode, Luis Rivera's testimony, and we're also going to hear some wiretapped phone calls, as well as from Catherine Magbanawa herself, as she testifies in her own defense. But first, in part one, we finished with Wendy Adelson's ex-boyfriend's testimony. This episode picks up right where we left off. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 93, Part 2. 'Tis the season to elect benefits through your workplace. Most people think of open enrollment as decision time for healthcare coverage, but it can also be the perfect time to reassess your life insurance needs. Did you know that to properly provide for their families, most people need 10 times the life insurance coverage than they get through their jobs? Which means that your employer life insurance is leaving you underinsured. And that is where Policy Genius can help. Policy Genius is the easy way to shop for a life insurance plan that's not tied to your job. In minutes, you can compare quotes from top insurers to find your best price. Once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and red tape. So when you're looking at your workplace benefits this month, make sure to double check your life insurance options. Then go to policygenius.com to get quotes and apply in minutes. Policy Genius, the easy way to compare and buy life insurance. In addition to Wendy Adelson, Luis Rivera was another star witness for the state, perhaps the star witness. The prosecution's entire theory of the case relied on information and details that Luis had laid out. And now he was in court, on the stand, ready to give those same details to the jury. Luis first testified about his deal with prosecutors. He said he was currently serving a sentence for this case and for an unrelated federal case. For this case, he said he pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and received 19 years in prison, which he is serving concurrently with his federal sentence, which is 12 and a half years. Since the sentences are running concurrently, his murder conviction adds just 7.5 years to his total. He said he had to cooperate with prosecutors in exchange for that sentence. But in addition to all of that, he said he also has pending violations of probation out of Miami, as well as a possession of cocaine with intent to sell charge. He's facing an additional 30 years for those. Luis told the court that he and Sigfredo were childhood friends and had grown up together. Around the time of the homicide, he said he was living with his girlfriend Jessica, the mother of his children. A few months prior to the murder, he said Sigfredo approached him about going to Tallahassee with him.
What did Mr. Garcia say when he approached you about coming to Tallahassee?
He just said, I got a job. Give me a job, I got to go do.
Said he had a job?
Yes, ma'am.
And the job was in Tallahassee?
Yes, ma'am.
And did he ask you to come with him?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you ask any questions about what the nature of the job was, why you needed to go all the way to Tallahassee or anything like that?
No, ma'am.
Why not?
Just my best friend and I trust him.
So you were automatically in to do whatever it was he wanted you to do?
Whatever he wanted to do over the road.
All right. Was money discussed as far as how you'd be compensated for this job?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
He was going to give me some money. He said, take a ride with me over to Tallahassee and I'll give you some money.
Did he say how much?
At that moment, yeah, he did. 35.
All right. 35 what?
35,000.
You were going to get $35,000 for this job?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. And did you have another conversation in the car on the way to Tallahassee?
Yes, ma'am.
How many trips did you make to Tallahassee?
Like twice.
All right. And were both trips with Mr. Garcia?
Yes, ma'am.
Was anybody else in the car on either of those trips?
Not at all.
Luis said he assumed they were going to do a robbery, but on the way to Tallahassee that first time in early June, Sigfredo told him that they were actually going to commit a murder.
He said we're going to have to kill the man.
He said you're going to have to kill the man?
Yeah.
And what was the second part of what you said?
For some kids.
For some kids. All right. Anything else? What did that mean to you, kill the man for some kids?
It's for a lady. I guess the lady wanted her kids back.
All right. So is this Garcia telling you this?
Yeah.
Did he have any information about who it was you were coming to Tallahassee to kill?
If he had information for who we're coming to kill?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What information did he have?
He had a piece of paper.
And where was the piece of paper?
He had it in his hand at that moment.
Okay. Did you see the piece of paper? Did you see what was on it?
Yes, ma'am.
What was on it?
A picture of the guy on what's the name?
Dan Markell.
Dan Markell.
The guy that y'all ended up killing.
Yes, ma'am. Is that the leading judge?
Overruled.
Is that the person whose picture was on the paper?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. And was there anything else on the paper other than a picture of Mr. Markell?
I think it was the address in it, too.
Okay.
He said Sigfredo rented the car and did the driving on the first trip, except for when he got a speeding ticket in Gainesville, Florida. He said they had switched for a minute, and Sigfredo then had him drive. He told the court that they arrived in Tallahassee around 5 or 6 in the morning on June 4th. He said they had two guns in the car. One was Sigfredo's and one was his. Lewis said he had purchased his gun on a street corner. It was an illegal gun purchase. When asked which gun ended up being the murder weapon, he said that one, the one he bought. Lewis said they were supposed to commit the murder on the first trip, but he said they couldn't keep track of Dan. They had followed him from a park near Dan's house to a daycare and then lost him. He said Sigfredo knew where Dan's house was. The address was on that piece of paper he had. Prosecutor Kappelman showed him an aerial map, and he identified the park where they waited, scoping Dan out. He said Sigfredo was driving when they did that. Lewis told the court that Sigfredo had about $2,000 to $5,000 on him during this trip. He said Sigfredo had gotten the money from the people who had hired him. Sigfredo didn't tell him who that was. They stayed in Tallahassee at a hotel for two or three nights. Prosecutor Kappelman asked if they had interacted with a man named Shadrick Nobles while they were at the hotel, and he said yes. Shadrick would be testifying later. Lewis said that the plan was for him to be the shooter on that first trip, but when he saw that Dan had kids, he decided he didn't want to be the shooter, and so it was decided that Sigfredo would do it. After the failed first trip, they went back to Miami. Sigfredo then called him one day and said they had to go back and do the job. They went back to Tallahassee on July 16th. This time, Lewis rented the car, a green Prius, and drove. They stayed at the same hotel as the last time. On Thursday, July 17th, he said they parked the car by the park near Dan's house, staking it out. He then said he saw a lady with two kids walking on the sidewalk.
All right. What happened when you saw this lady? Did she see you?
Yeah, she looked dead at the car. I was driving, and as I looked in my rear mirror, I seen her looking.
Mm-hmm.
So
what
I asked,
happened next?
I asked her, see her. What's up with this lady? Was she looking at the car? And I asked that lady with the kids, man.
So you asked Garcia, hey, who's this lady that's looking at the car?
Yes, ma'am.
And he said, that's the lady with the kids.
Yes, ma'am.
And what did you take that to mean?
That's the lady that wanted the kids.
The lady that wanted you to do this job?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. And were you worried about seeing her there?
Yes, ma'am.
Were you worried about her seeing you there?
Of course.
Were you concerned? Did you ever ask Garcia, who knows that I'm involved in this job with you?
I can't remember.
Can't remember that?
No.
Okay. What did you do once you see this lady and Garcia tells you that's the lady that wants this job done?
We drove off. We left.
Okay. Did Garcia make a phone call about seeing the lady?
Well, I'm looking through the rearview mirror, and I seen her making a phone call. I seen her getting on the phone.
The lady that you saw on the sidewalk?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And then y'all drove off?
We drove off.
Okay. And did Mr. Garcia, after seeing that and driving off, did he make any phone calls?
After we done bent like the corner, he got on the phone.
All right. And who did he get on the phone with?
I believe he got on the phone with Katie.
How do you know it was Katie he got on the phone with?
Because she, like, the way he was talking, it's only her. He only talks to her.
All right. And what do you mean the way he was talking? How are you able to tell?
Like, when he spoke to her, she like, y'all get out of there. The lady just seen y'all.
All right. And so y'all were worried about this lady having seen you?
Oh, I was worried.
You were?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And were you able, you said that you believe Garcia called Katie. Could you actually hear her, or you could only hear his end of the conversation?
I'm hearing his end of the conversation right now.
All right. And tell us about his end of the conversation. What did you hear?
He like, we just got to go. Like, let's get out of here.
He said Sigfredo told him that they had to get the job done because Dan was supposed to leave to go out of town that Friday morning. Lewis said later that day, he posted a photo of an owl he saw on Instagram. Afterwards, Sigfredo received a phone call and then told Lewis that he needed to take that shit down.
Garcia told you that?
Yes, ma'am.
And who told him that?
I believe Katie.
You believe Katie or
no,
you know Katie?
It's Katie. It's her.
Okay. So did Garcia get a phone call about the Instagram photo that you posted?
Yes, ma'am.
And were you present when he received that phone call?
I was outside. Okay. He came outside and told me.
He came outside and told you to take it down?
Yeah.
All right.
Lewis told the court that they saw Shadrick Nobles again on this trip, too. They were buying drugs from him. Lewis said they also had an issue with the car on the second trip. He said he was driving and Sigfredo pulled the murder weapon out and accidentally shot a hole right through the car. The bullet hit a gas line, disabling the vehicle, and so they pushed it into a parking lot. Sigfredo then got a ride with Shadrick to AutoZone. When they got back, he fixed the car. At some point, Lewis said he recalled overhearing a conversation between Catherine and Sigfredo.
Do you remember any conversation where Ms. Magbanawa was indicating to Mr. Garcia where you could hear her saying, make sure you get everything done right. When you are done, call me.
Yes.
On the day of the murder, Lewis said he was driving. They again went to the park around the corner from Dan's house to wait. Once they saw Dan's car, they followed him to the daycare and then to the gym. He said he can't remember, but he thinks they may have turned their phones off. When Dan got out of the gym, they followed him all the way back to his house. Dan pulled into the driveway and Lewis pulled up right behind him. He could see Dan talking on the phone.
And what happened once you pulled into his driveway?
Soon as I pulled in, Garcia jumped off. Jumped out of the car and went around. Not around, but in front of the car.
Mm-hmm.
Right behind his car and in front of the car I was driving. Went to the driver's side and shot him.
He shot Mr. Markell?
Yes, ma'am.
How many times?
Twice.
Did you actually see Mr. Garcia shoot Mr. Markell?
Of course.
He said Sigfredo then got back into the car and they left, the same way they came in, back to Miami. In the moments after the homicide and that surveillance video from the city bus system, there was animated movement on the passenger side of the car. Lewis said that this was when Sigfredo was trying to hide the gun in the car. He said Sigfredo was nervous after shooting Dan.
What happened to the murder weapon in this case?
We dumped it.
Where did y'all dump it?
In the lake.
All right, what lake?
In a bridge, in hotel, on one of the bridges.
All right, was it on the way between Tallahassee and Miami?
Yes, ma'am.
And were you able to say exactly which bridge it was?
I can't remember.
But the gun was thrown into a body of water?
Yes, ma'am.
And who threw the gun into the body of water?
Garcia.
Did you ride around with law enforcement much later looking for this location?
Yes, ma'am.
The murder weapon, however, was never found. As they were driving back to Miami, Lewis said Sigfredo spoke to Catherine on the phone. He said it was the first call they made after they turned their phones back on.
How do you know that that call was to Katie?
Because when he was speaking, he like, hey, the shit is done. She goes, I already know it's done.
All right. And when she said, I already know it's done, was that something that you heard or that Garcia told you?
I heard.
How were you able to hear it?
Because I'm in the car with him. The windows are up and she's on the phone.
So her voice was loud enough through the receiver that you were able to hear her. And could you identify her voice as being hers and not somebody else's?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. So tell us again what exactly was said.
He said, we already finished. He goes, I already know it's done.
All right. And then what?
And then we asked for the money. Like, where the money at? So you'll get it tomorrow.
Who said you'll get it tomorrow?
Katie.
Who was responsible for getting the money?
I believe Katie.
All right. And you said, why do you say you believe Katie? Was it Katie or not?
Yes, it was Katie.
All right. And did you know where she was going to get the money from?
If I knew, not really, but we know the lady, Wendy, was paying it.
All right. So you knew that the job was being done so that Wendy could get her kids.
Yes, ma'am.
Later that night, he said he and Sigfredo went to a bar called Big Daddy's. They were anticipating getting paid the next day, so they were spending what they had. He said Sigfredo told him that he was getting $40,000, Louis was getting $35,000, and Catherine was getting the rest of the total $100,000. The next day, Catherine called him while he was at the barber shop.
I was in a barber shop the next morning. I get a phone call from Katie. Hey, where's Tuto? Where's Tuto?
And Tuto is Mr. Garcia?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, so Katie, you talked to Katie on the phone that day.
Yes, I did.
And that was pretty unusual because y'all don't usually talk on the phone, right?
Yes, ma'am, we don't.
All right, and she says, where's Tuto? Did you know where Tuto was?
Objection, leading.
Yes.
Overruled.
And where was Tuto?
And Shrimp's house.
And who's Shrimp?
Oh, his girlfriend.
Okay, so that's a woman that he was seeing around that time?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, and what did she say? Did she say anything about the money?
Yeah, she said he was going to come get this money. I said, he is. You go get it.
All right, so she wanted to know who was going to come get the money.
Yes, ma'am.
And were you able to locate Mr. Garcia?
Of course.
And did y'all go get the money?
I didn't go get it. He went and get it.
You didn't get your money?
I was in a barbershop still. They brought the money to my house.
Okay, and did you go to your house to get the money?
Yes, ma'am.
Who was present when you went to your house and got your money?
Garcia and Katie.
All right, and is that the house that we talked about earlier that you lived at with Jessica?
Yes, ma'am.
He said the money was in clear plastic in a brown paper bag. The money was all $100 bills stapled together in $1,000 increments.
And were you a member of this conspiracy to accomplish the murder of Mr. Markell?
Not at all.
You didn't have anything to do with it?
I mean, and yeah, he told me about it to go, but if you're saying if I got hired, no.
Well, you got paid, didn't you?
Yeah, from Garcia.
All right, so Garcia hired you to do a murder, didn't he?
Yes, ma'am.
And who hired him?
The Addison family.
I'm sorry?
The Wendy family.
Wendy's family hired him?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And how was Wendy's family connected to Sigfredo Garcia?
Because Katie. Katie was dating the dentist.
Okay. Did Katie know about the murder?
Yes, ma'am.
Did Katie have a role in hiring Sigfredo Garcia?
Yes, ma'am.
How do you know that?
Because he told me.
He said he had never had any communication or connection with the Adelson family. On cross-examination, Sigfredo's attorney, Sam Zangane, immediately questioned Louis about his involvement in the Latin King Street Gang. Louis acknowledged that he was the leader of the North Miami tribe and said he had been his entire adult life. When asked how many members there were in 2014, he estimated about 100 in just North Miami. Zangane asked him, county by county, if there were members there, and Louis said yes. But when Zangane got to Tallahassee, Louis said he didn't know.
So could you pick up a phone and call somebody and get information on somebody that's associated with the Latin Kings in, let's say, Jacksonville? Could you do that?
You'd be the leader, of course.
Okay. And you were a leader, right?
Yes, sir.
So what about, could you pick up the phone and find out if there's people in Gainesville? You could do that as a leader, right?
Yes, sir.
Everywhere, right?
Everywhere.
Okay. Because in addition to being a local organization, it's a statewide and national organization, correct?
Yes, sir.
Louis was asked if he sold drugs, and he said yes. He did that to take care of his family and of the Latin King Nation. He was then asked about a code of silence.
So one of the principles that's in your rule book is that whatever activity you do within your organization should maintain within that organization. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And whatever activity that you do, if it's illegal, you're not supposed to talk about it, correct?
Of course.
Now, according to your book, the KMC, is there a punishment or a violation that one receives if you provide information against another Latin King?
What do you mean by that?
So let's say a buddy of yours, one of your brothers, let's call him King Anthony, okay? Let's say King Anthony did a crime and you helped the prosecution or you helped the police prosecute him. Would that be a violation according to your rule book?
Objection, relevance, and hypothetical.
Overruled.
Go ahead, sir.
Of course.
What would be your punishment?
I'm going through it right now. They're trying to kill me.
They're going to try to kill you.
Yeah.
So you'll agree with me that cooperating against a fellow king would result in probably the most serious penalty that you can have in your manifesto, correct?
Of course.
Loss of your life.
Yes, sir.
Before we continue, I want to stop right here just a second. You might be wondering why Zangane is asking all these questions about Louis's membership in the Latin Kings. That's because in his opening statements, Zangane said that their theory is that Louis was hired by Charlie directly, and then he and a fellow Latin King member actually committed the murder, not Sigfredo. Louis told the jury that he is no longer a member of the Latin Kings. He said he lost his membership in 2016 after he agreed to cooperate in this case.
Have you ever instilled the use of other Latin Kings to further any kind of violent criminal act?
Yes, sir.
In fact, in the 1 month that your phone had a wire intercept, you attempted 3 separate violent acts reaching out to other fellow Latin Kings. Isn't that correct?
Objection,
yes,
relevance?
Olive rule.
So you can answer that question.
Yes, sir.
Zangane then questioned Louis about the murder weapon, which Louis claims he bought on a street corner.
So instead of calling one of your 100 gang member brothers, where you are the king of the castle, the lion of the jungle, you choose to go to the hood and ask a stranger for a gun. That's your testimony?
Yes, sir, because okay. They don't got nothing to do with what I'm about to do.
Louis was then asked about Sigfredo's feelings towards Charlie Adelson.
Would it be fair to say that he was unhappy with her relationship with the dentist, correct?
Yes, sir.
With Dr. Adelson, correct? Charlie yes, Adelson, right?
Yes, sir.
Would it be fair to say that you'd be able to see the anger in his face, correct?
Of course.
You would see that he would be sad, correct?
Yes, sir.
Yet it's your testimony that Mr. Garcia agreed to do an act that the Adelsons wanted, right?
Yes, sir.
Louis maintained throughout questioning that he did not know Charlie.
It's your testimony that you'd never seen Charlie Adelson, correct?
Yes, sir.
So you would deny selling drugs to Charlie Adelson?
Objection.
This is fine.
Zangane then turned his attention to where Louis took detectives in search of the alleged murder weapon.
Did you just take law enforcement to a known dumping ground for Latin Kings to dump firearms?
Latin Kings?
You're a Latin King.
Why you keep saying Latin Kings? It ain't got nothing to do with this. You're wrong. You're wrong, man. This ain't got nothing to do with no Latin Kings.
So
it got to do with me, Garcia. No Latin Kings.
So you're not answering my question.
Asking a straightforward question.
I said no.
During cross-examination with Catherine's attorney, Louis said he only knew her through Sigfredo. He recalled that Sigfredo would often watch the kids while Catherine worked at various clubs. He agreed that it was common knowledge for everyone who knew them that Catherine was working for Charlie. He also agreed that Sigfredo was angry that Catherine, the mother of his kids, was dating Charlie. He recalled one night sitting outside of a restaurant with Sigfredo, watching Catherine and Charlie eat. He said Sigfredo was upset and even said he wanted to run them over. Louis said he talked him out of it. Catherine's attorney, Tara Cowis, questioned him about inconsistencies in his statements, specifically regarding when he found out that they were going to commit a murder. At a deposition, he had said he had found out about that on the way to Tallahassee. In another interview, he said before they went. She said he went back and forth on this. She said there were also inconsistencies about who was financing the murder. One time, he said Sigfredo told him that Wendy was financing it. But then in an interview with detectives, he called her the lady with the kids and said he didn't know her name. Later, he referred to her as Wendy again. And then later still, he called her the dentist's sister. Louis said Sigfredo never had any contact with Wendy, that it was Catherine's job to talk to the Adelsons. Kawa said Lewis was also inconsistent about who drove on the first trip and when he heard Sigfredo and Catherine talking on the phone. She asked how he was able to identify Catherine's voice.
You already testified that you don't talk to her on the phone, right?
I don't.
You're not friends with her.
I know her.
You know her?
Yeah, I know her.
But you guys don't talk on the phone every day.
Well, I don't. I don't know who's going to call her.
I understand, but I'm saying you don't
know. No, ma'am.
You don't speak to her on the phone every day, right?
No, ma'am.
She doesn't speak with an impediment, does she?
What would that mean?
Does she speak with like any type of stutter or, you know, anything that would make her voice stand out?
No.
Does she speak with an accent?
Okay, no.
No? Okay.
After Lewis's testimony, prosecutors called various witnesses to the stand who they believed could corroborate things he said. A man named Shadrick Nobles testified that he met with Lewis and Sigfredo on both of their trips to Tallahassee. He said he sold cocaine to Sigfredo and also took them to AutoZone to fix the Prius after Sigfredo shot a hole through the floor. He said both Lewis and Sigfredo went with him to AutoZone and that he waited in the car while the two of them went inside. An employee from a rental car company testified that Sigfredo came in and rented a car on June 3rd, 2014. They made a copy of his driver's license, which was shown to the court. On cross-examination, he agreed that he wouldn't know if someone else drove the car. June Umchinda was an ex-girlfriend of Charlie Adelson's, who dated him after the murder and after he and Catherine broke up, from October 2015 to June 2017. She said that although they're no longer dating, they still keep in touch, and that she spoke with him as recently as a day prior to her testimony.
And has Mr. Adelson ever talked to you about the murder of Dan Markell?
He has, because it's a big, you know, thing right now, so we did obviously speak about it.
Mm-hmm. And he's never made any admissions to you, has he, about being involved in the murder?
No.
All right. Did he ever, I don't know, let me ask you this. Around the time of May 2016, when the arrests were made in this case, or some arrests were made, and there was some media attention increased, did you notice a change in the behavior of Mr. Adelson?
Yes, I did.
Could you explain that to the jury, please?
He was just acting stressed and irrational. Were you talking about when the media broadcasted everything or beforehand when people were were arrested?
Why don't we start with when people were arrested? Did you notice a change in his behavior at that time?
Yes.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, obviously they were tracing things back to him, so he was nervous and worried and just not himself.
Okay. And was he doing things like sleeping with a gun?
He usually does that.
So. Oh, he did that anyway?
Yeah.
Okay. And so you just noticed that his demeanor had changed. He seemed to be more stressed out.
There was something about him and he wouldn't really tell me. So yes, he was stressed out.
So he wouldn't tell you really what the problem was?
No.
In response to Prosecutor Kappelman's questions, June told the court that she never saw Charlie interact with any known gang members or use any drugs. She said she did see him with large amounts of cash at times. He had a safe in his bedroom that was the size of a refrigerator. And how he kept that cash was something she noticed.
And is there anything unusual about the way Mr. Adelson packages his cash?
No, I've never seen it physically. Like, I don't look in his safe.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen him take money out of it.
Okay, so but, you didn't. Do you recall giving a statement back on July 24th, 2018? To law enforcement?
Yes. And I wanted to say at that time, obviously, you know, he just had a baby with someone else. And that's the primary reason we broke up. So when I gave that interview, the baby was 6 months old. and Bree moved into the house and they got a dog, and I thought I would never speak to him again. So I was obviously, you know, hurt and angry. And
okay. So were you lying to law enforcement back in July 24th, 2018 because of your
no.
anger? Okay. So I want to ask you specifically, in that interview, did you talk about observing large amounts of cash lying around the house when you were dating Charlie Adelson?
Yes.
Okay. And did you talk about a particular way that the money was separated or packaged?
I did mention that there was a staple on one of them. So mm-hmm. I kind of like joked to him about it.
In fact, you said that the money was stapled into stacks of $100 bills, didn't you?
They were hundreds, yes. And okay. I don't know if they were stacks, but there was a staple on it.
She said she didn't know where the cash came from. She was asked if she received any gifts from Charlie after they broke up, and she said no.
Did you notice an increase in Mr. Adelson's contact with Ms. Magbanua after the media attention started in reference to this case?
No, no.
Do you remember giving that statement back on July 24th, 2016 to law enforcement?
I remember something was brought up about Catherine's car needed to be fixed. So that was brought up and I mentioned it to him, you know, just asking about it.
Okay. And did you tell law enforcement that Charlie started talking to Catherine a lot more after the media attention started?
I noticed he met with her like twice, I would say.
Okay.
So...
did you ever know of Catherine Magbanua working for Charlie at his dental practice? I'm sorry. Yeah, periodontal practice.
No, I met him after he was with Catherine, so.
Okay, and when you met him in October of 2015, Ms. Magbanua was not employed at his office, to your knowledge?
I actually met Charlie like a year ago before that, but we reconnected a year later.
All right. I guess during any of the time that you knew Mr. Adelson, were you aware of Ms. Magbanua working
no.
at his office? Okay.
She was asked about additional things she said to investigators. June told Prosecutor Kappelman that she was unaware she was being recorded when speaking to them. On cross-examination with Sigfredo's attorney, June said police had showed up at her home multiple times. When she spoke with them, she said it was in the lobby of her condo. She reiterated that she was not aware that she was being recorded. The jurors also asked June a question. They asked her about her having talked to Charlie the day prior to her testimony. She said she had texted him as she was getting on a plane to come here, and that they texted more throughout the day. Yindra Velasquez-Mascaro testified that she was a friend of Catherine's. And in fact, she said Catherine is the godmother to one of her children. She said she knew Sigfredo and Louis as well, that they had all been childhood friends. Yindra was also the third woman pictured in that photo at the beach with Catherine and Wendy on Father's Day weekend in 2014. Yindra said that was the first time she had ever met Wendy. Yindra told the jury that, to her knowledge, Catherine had never worked at the Adelson Institute, but she did say that Catherine used to work at various nightclubs where they got paid in cash. She said Catherine worked at a club called Club Fate and then Hollywood Live. But in May 2014, she was over the club scene, and so she quit. After the murder, she said she knew Catherine worked at a dermatology office that was owned by Charlie's best friend and former roommate for a while. She worked there for just a couple months, and then she started working with Yindra as an assistant to one of the realtors at a realty company. In May 2016, Catherine stopped working there after Sigfredo got arrested. Yindra testified that they were supposed to go to Disney that following weekend after the arrest, but Catherine didn't end up going.
After Mr. Garcia was arrested, what type of contact did you have with Ms. Magbanua after that?
Not much. Here and there, I would just ask her how the kids were doing and how she was holding up.
You would describe it as her kind of going off the radar, right?
Yes.
she didn't really talk to anybody at that time?
No, ma'am.
Has she ever, meaning Ms. McVanwa, ever talked to you about Mr. Garcia being arrested?
No.
Or any of the news stories around this case?
No.
She told the court that she knew that Catherine and Charlie Adelson had dated, but she had only met Charlie a couple times. She said Catherine met him while she worked at a dental office called Sophie Dental. Charlie was a periodontist and would come in every once in a while to perform procedures on their patients. The night before Dan was murdered, she said Catherine asked her to watch her kids.
I want to jump back a little bit in time to 2014.
Okay.
Was there ever a time that Ms. McVanwa asked you to watch her children?
Yes.
When was that?
July 2014.
July 2014?
Correct.
And was it weird for her to ask you to watch her kids, or normal occurrence, or what?
No, normal. I mean, if she needed a favor, I would do it. If I needed a favor, she would do it, you know, in regards to the kids.
Do you know why she didn't ask Mr. Garcia to take care of his
kids? No.
She didn't cause the speculation.
I'm asking if she knows.
Overruled.
Do you know? I don't know.
So she leaves the kids with you, and did they stay with you overnight?
They did. They ended up falling asleep, so they just stayed there. There was no point of her picking them up. It was too late in the day.
Then the next day, did you receive a call from Ms. McVanwa?
Yes.
And what did she tell you at that time?
She had told me that Charlie's brother-in-law had an accident.
What kind of accident?
It was, they literally said an accident.
So you watch her kids next day. She says Charlie Adelson's brother has had an accident.
Brother-in-law.
And did she say what, if anything, Charlie Adelson was going to have to do because of that accident?
That he was going to go up to see what, you know, the situation was and to see his sister and make sure everything was okay.
And this was July 2014?
Yes.
Did you later find out that the accident was Dan Markell being executed in his garage?
Correct.
She said Catherine and Sigfredo got back together on May 2, 2015. She remembers the date because it was the date of the Manny Pacquiao versus Floyd Mayweather fight. Catherine and Charlie had broken up a few months prior to that. Yindra was also asked about Catherine's cars. She said Catherine used to drive a white Mazda, but she kept having problems with it. She said she knew Charlie then gave Catherine a Lexus in late 2015 or early 2016. It was her understanding that it had been a gift. Catherine was back together with Sigfredo at the time. When asked to describe the Lexus, she said it was well-kept and pristine. But before long, Catherine was having trouble with the Lexus too. Yindra said she wasn't sure who was paying for the car's repairs. On cross-examination, Yindra said that Sigfredo was furious about Catherine dating Charlie. Yindra was also asked about how much cash she and Catherine would make when working at the clubs. She said they would make up to $500 on a good night, but that typically it was around $100 to $200. The prosecution then called two employees from the Adelson Institute to the stand. Harvey Adelson's assistant testified that she knows Catherine from coming into the institute as a patient, but she had never seen her working at the office. She said she didn't know of any employees ever working remotely. Another dental assistant, Erica Johnson, testified that on June 1st, 2016, two law enforcement officers came into the office and asked for Catherine's employment records. She said she didn't have control of those records, that either Harvey or Donna Adelson would. While the officers were there, Erica went into the back office and called Charlie. That phone call was played in court.
Hey, the FBI is here asking for records for Katie.
For what?
That she works here?
I wouldn't get anything.
Yeah, and then the ex, did she work there? I was like, yeah, she worked there, but I don't know what you want. So the man was sent there to Erica. Yeah.
Do me a favor. I'm not there right now.
Uh-huh.
And I'm in surgery.
Uh-huh.
But It's not my office. It's my dad's office.
Uh-huh.
So I can't give anything out.
Right.
So I don't have access to it. I don't know where anything is.
Okay.
So you don't have access to anything.
I don't know where anything is either.
Yeah, so I would do this. I would not speak to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You can do whatever you want, but it's my dad's office.
Yeah.
So I don't have access to any of that stuff.
Okay.
So they can talk to my dad, and I'm sure they'll be able to get whatever they want from them.
Okay, understandable.
Charlie then tells her she can talk to whoever she wants, that he shouldn't tell her not to talk to them. But, he said, it's not my office, and it's not your office, so we don't have records to give them.
Are they there now, or are they just standing?
They're there, but no, I'm in the back. They're just waiting for me to come back.
Oh, and they want records?
Yes.
Do me a favor. I'm going to call you from a landline on your cell phone, okay?
Okay.
All right, bye.
Assistant State's Attorney Anna Norris asked why she called Charlie about it, and she said because Catherine was his girlfriend, and she knew he would answer the phone faster than Harvey Adelson, Charlie's dad. We'll get into more trial testimony right after this quick break from today's sponsors. Whenever I talk about stamps.com, I wonder who in the world still goes to the post office and why. When stamps.com brings the post office right to you, there's no need to interrupt your workday to fight traffic to get to the post office, especially now during the holidays when it's extra busy with people sending holiday cards and gifts. That's why you need stamps.com. Anything you can do at the post office, you can do at stamps.com. Stamps.com eliminates trips to the post office and saves you money with the discounts that you can't even get there. Whether you're a small office sending out invoices, an online seller shipping out products, or even a warehouse sending thousands of packages a day, Stamps.com can handle it all with ease. Simply use your computer to print official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you want to send. Once your mail is ready, just hand it to your mail carrier or drop it in a mailbox. It's that simple. And with stamps.com, you get 5 cents off every first class stamp and up to 40% off priority mail. Not to mention, it's a fraction of the cost of those expensive postage meters. Stamps.com is a no-brainer, saving you time and money. It's no wonder over 700,000 small businesses already use stamps.com. Don't spend a minute of your holiday season at the post office this year. Sign up for stamps.com instead. There's no risk, and with my promo code CORD, you get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in CORD. That's stamps.com, enter code CORD. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again.
From the Lady Gang Network and Podcast One.
I dated a lot of gay men in my life.
Maybe I didn't know I was gay until you liked me.
It's Showmance with Kevin McHale and Jenna Ushkowitz.
How romantic.
Join the former Glee stars and best friends for an untraditional take on finding love and friendship in the world of show business.
As the modern poet Jenna Ushkowitz once said, tradition.
Don't miss new episodes of Showmance with Kevin and Jenna every Thursday on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hope you find friends as good as us.
Sergeant Chris Corbett testified about phone records in the case and how they were able to track Sigfredo, Lewis, and Catherine's movements using the location data. Using the location data, as well as information from the surveillance video and other evidence they collected, here's the timeline prosecutors presented in court from the first trip they say Lewis and Sigfredo took to Tallahassee. Sergeant Corbett said that Lewis's records show him leaving the Miami area on June 4th, 2014. He receives a traffic citation at 9:12 a.m. He arrives in Tallahassee a little after noon. On the morning of June 5th, Lewis's phone is near a parking lot of a budget inn. Then, around 12:30 to 3:25 p.m., his phone is near a park by Dan Markell's house. Then his phone shows him traveling back towards Miami. He arrives just after midnight on June 6th. Sergeant Corbett said they do not have location data for Sigfredo's phone during this time period. He said Metro PCS was in the process of being taken over by T-Mobile. They requested the information from both companies, but neither was able to provide location data for the phone. On June 2nd, 2014, right before that first Tallahassee trip, Sergeant Corbett said that Catherine's location shows her by a rental car place around 8:53 p.m. During that time, she had no contact with Sigfredo's phone. At 8:57 p.m., Charlie tried calling her. At 9:17 p.m., they spoke for over 25 minutes, and at this point, Catherine's phone was traveling back towards her house. Lewis's location data during that same time frame showed that he was near his residence. On June 6th, the day the rental car was returned, the car's GPS shows that it was in close proximity to Catherine's residence at 8:48 a.m. This would be about 8 hours after the car returned from Tallahassee. Lewis's phone was by his residence at this time. Later that day, Catherine's phone records show travel towards the rental car place. Now, before we continue on, I want to take a moment to clarify what I believe the prosecution was trying to show with this evidence. Sigfredo's defense team says that Sigfredo was not with Lewis during that first Tallahassee trip, and they say that there aren't any phone records to show that he was. However, there is a rental car agreement with Sigfredo's name on it, and Catherine's phone shows that she was near the rental car place when the car was being rented out and when it was being returned. I believe prosecutors are trying to show that Sigfredo rented the car, as Lewis said, and that he also returned the car. And they're trying to show that Catherine was with him both times. Now, all of this would suggest that Sigfredo did go on that Tallahassee trip, as Lewis had said. And Catherine being with Sigfredo when the car was rented would go towards showing her involvement. Now, as for the trip to Tallahassee in July, when the murder actually did take place, prosecutors do have location data for both Sigfredo and Lewis's phones. Here's the timeline for that trip, as presented in court. On the night of July 14th, 2014, location info for Charlie's phone was consistent with going to dinner with Catherine that evening. Then at 1 a.m., his phone departed her residence. At 1:56 a.m., Catherine called Sigfredo, and they spoke for 2 minutes and 30 seconds. The next day, on July 15th, the car for the trip was rented. This is the rental agreement that Lewis signed with the word brother written at the top, along with Sigfredo's number. At 10:15 that night, the rental car's GPS shows that it was in the parking lot of Catherine's residence. On the night of July 16th, Lewis and Sigfredo arrive in Tallahassee just after midnight. On July 17th, their phones are at the Budget Inn and then by Dan Markell's house. Sergeant Corbett was asked if he's familiar with Lewis's testimony about having seen Wendy walking down the street on this day, the day before the murder. He said yes. He was asked if he was able to get location data for Wendy's phone, and he said yes. He told the jury that it's possible that she was there, but unlikely. She was returning home from work around that time, and she does travel that way, but the timing would be awfully tight, he said. July 18th was the day of the murder. The prosecution laid out a timeline of phone calls that were made during this time period. Around midnight, Catherine's phone connects with Sigfredo's phone, and then a few minutes later, with Charlie's. At 1:02 a.m., Charlie calls his mother Donna, but they do not connect. A minute after that, Charlie calls Catherine, and they speak again for about 20 minutes. Later that morning, beginning at 8:09 a.m., Wendy's phone contacts Donna's phone as well as Charlie's. At 9:19 a.m., Wendy and Charlie talk for a little over 18 minutes. Right around this time is when Sigfredo and Lewis's phones are at the Premier Gym, where Dan was working out. The Prius they rented can be seen on surveillance video in the parking lot. At 9:38 a.m., Charlie calls his mother, Donna. This call lasts for 30 seconds, and then Charlie and Catherine then call each other a few times, at one point talking on the phone for about 7 minutes. At 10:06 a.m., Charlie calls Wendy, but it only lasts for 11 seconds. Then Charlie and Catherine call each other a few times again before speaking for 6 minutes. Dan was killed just before 11 a.m. The 911 call came in at 11:02 a.m. At 11:06 a.m., Donna calls Charlie, and then he calls her about 15 minutes later. They talk for about 7 minutes. At 11:42 a.m., Wendy tries calling Dan's phone. The last activity from Sigfredo's phone during this time was at 9:58 a.m. Then the next activity is at 12:30 p.m., which is an outgoing call to Catherine. It was short in duration, but there were no indications that a voicemail was left. The phones were traveling back south. Sergeant Corbett said there were voicemails left on Sigfredo's phone between the time of 10 a.m. and 12:30 p.m., which he said is consistent with the phone having been turned off. Later that night, when Lewis and Sigfredo are back in Miami, Catherine's location data shows her near her residence. At 8:36 p.m., she calls Charlie, and then she and Sigfredo exchange a few calls. During this time, her location shows her leaving her residence. At 9:42 p.m., Catherine calls Charlie again. At this time, her phone is in the area of Lewis's residence, as are Sigfredo and Lewis's phones. They are all consistent in being in the same area, and communication between the three of them cease. At 10:12 p.m., Charlie calls Catherine and it goes to her voicemail. At 10:20 p.m., she calls Charlie back. She is still in the area of Lewis's residence, along with Sigfredo and Lewis. The next day, the day after the murder, Catherine tried to contact Sigfredo repeatedly, but they do not connect. She then called a man named Anthony, who then also attempts to call Sigfredo, but doesn't get through. At 10:22 a.m., Catherine then calls Lewis. She calls again at 10:23 and 10:31. Sergeant Corbett said that in all the records he looked at, he had never seen Catherine call Lewis before. According to her location data, while Catherine is making calls trying to get a hold of Sigfredo, her phone is traveling south from the direction in which Charlie lives and heading toward Lewis's residence. Lewis's location is now consistent with being at home. As you'll recall, this is around the time when Lewis says Catherine came over to his house and the money was handed over. During this time, Sergeant Corbett said that Sigfredo's phone could have been powered down, or he said it could be that he was no longer using that phone, which is why Catherine wasn't able to get a hold of him. The phone's account terminated completely in August. Sergeant Corbett also testified about a phone call from Sigfredo's cell phone to Harvey Adelson, Wendy and Charlie's father, at 5:20 p.m. on July 1st, 2014. It was an attempted call that went to Harvey's voicemail. This was the only discovered communication between Sigfredo and any of the Adelsons.
Is there any evidence or proof of communication in anything that you've reviewed whatsoever between the Adelsons and Lewis Rivera?
No.
Based on that same data, is there any evidence or proof of communication whatsoever between the Adelsons and Sigfredo Garcia?
Just the one phone call, attempted phone call to Mr. Adelson, Harvey Adelson, is the only contact.
That was the July 1, 2014 call?
Yes.
Same question. Any evidence or proof of communication between Charlie Adelson and Sigfredo Garcia?
No.
Any evidence or proof of Charlie Adelson and Lewis Rivera communicating?
No.
On cross-examination with Catherine's attorney, Sergeant Corbett was asked to read a text message exchange between Catherine and Charlie from April 2014, 3 months before the murder. For reference, Tuto is Sigfredo's nickname. Catherine texted Charlie, "Did Tuto call your phone?" Charlie responded, "No." Charlie then wrote, "Actually, he did. He invited me to go deep sea fishing. He was so nice." Catherine then wrote, "I'm serious. He's fucking driving me crazy. Is your cell phone listed online?" Charlie said, "I don't think my cell is listed online." Catherine's attorney also pointed out that both Louis and Sigfredo stopped using their cell phones after the murder, but that Catherine did not. Prosecutors called Mary Hall, a financial expert who analyzed bank records in the case, to the stand. Hall testified that she looked through all of Catherine's accounts, searching for a potential payment she could have made for the Adelson's Lexus.
What were your results?
I could not find any record of a payment.
According to Catherine's bank records, in 2013, a year prior to the murder, her highest source of income came from Sophie Dental, the dental office where she worked then. In 2014, the year of the murder, her highest source of income was cash deposits, then Sophie Dental. In 2015, cash deposits and then Adelson Institute were her highest sources of income. In total, cash deposits were her highest source of income from 2013 to 2016. She deposited a total of $88,021 in cash during that time. Hull testified that there was an increase in cash deposits after July 18, 2014, the day of the murder. Catherine received checks from the Adelson Institute from October 2014. Through May 2016. She also received checks from a dermatology office owned by Charlie's friend from July 2015 through March 2016. The checks from the Adelson Institute were biweekly and were in the amount of $407.58. Hull also testified that Catherine got a breast augmentation on October 18, 2014. The cost was $4,595, but there were only two payments made from Catherine's account for that. Both were for the consultation fee, which was just $195. Hull said she did not see any corresponding cash withdrawals from Catherine's account leading up to the surgery. Hull also noted that around the time of the surgery, the checks from Adelson Institute remained the same. There was no reduction in pay for any time off. Hull was asked to read a text message exchange between Catherine and Charlie from May 2015. Remember that during this time, Catherine and Charlie had already broken up, and Catherine was back together with Sigfredo. On May 20th, 2015, Catherine texts Charlie and asks him for money. Quote, "Hey, by the way, I have a shitload of things to pay for. I need a little help because of the kids' tuition and crap for summer and that I had to stop my weekend job. I hate asking," she wrote. Charlie replied, "I will lend you whatever you need." Catherine responded, "It's just tight this month with my accidents and shit. I'm going to have to start working on the corner." Hull said that at this time, Catherine had $15,582 in her accounts. After this text exchange, 6 days later, a cash deposit of $1,400 was made into her account. There were additional text messages that Hull read aloud in court that referenced Charlie paying for Catherine's Mazda repairs. And yet another text exchange in May 2015, Catherine texts Charlie and asks him about the paychecks she's receiving from Adelson Institute. She asks if he can ask his mom how much she deducts for Social Security, etc. Charlie gives her the amounts, and she responds, "Not that they ever call, just in case." As for Lewis's bank records, Hull testified that prior to the murder, Lewis had a very distinctive pattern. A check would be deposited weekly into his bank account from the place where he worked. It would then almost immediately be withdrawn in cash. This would cause automated payments he had set up to charge a number of overdraft fees. There were so many that they equated to one paycheck. But there was a change after the murder. There were very little cash withdrawals and no overdraft fees. This, however, only lasted for a couple months. As for Sigfredo, Hull testified that he had closed out his bank accounts, and so they could not get that info for the time of the murder. Oscar Jimenez, a special agent with the FBI, testified that he was part of an undercover operation in this case. As Prosecutor Kappelman laid out in her opening statements, Jimenez's role was to represent a Latin King member and to approach Donna Adelson, Wendy and Charlie's mom, in Miami. On April 19th, 2016, he approached her on the street and handed her a flyer. It was a news article about Dan's murder. On it, he had written $5,000 along with a cell phone number. Jimenez was wearing a body cam that recorded video and audio. A surveillance team was also recording.
Excuse me, Mrs. Adelson?
How you doing? Just want to give you this. Listen.
You? You're scaring me.
No, don't be scared. Listen, just want to let you know that we know that your family has been taking care of Katie and her friend Duto for quite some time after your problem up north has been resolved. And I want to let you know that my brother, he's incarcerated. He helped your family with this problem you guys had up north. And we want to make sure that he's going through some rough times. And we want to make sure that you take care of what he's going through, the way you're taking care of Katie and Tuka.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, this will explain it.
He handed her a piece of paper and then walked away. The idea was that he was trying to extort money from her on behalf of Lewis. Jimenez told the jury that this type of operation is referred to as a bump. The purpose is to try and generate a conversation that law enforcement can then wiretap and record. Sergeant Chris Corbett took the stand again and testified that oftentimes suspects will talk in code. This set up the playing of the wiretaps when Special Agent Patrick Sanford took the stand. On the same day that bump occurred, Charlie called Catherine and told her about it. Here are parts of that conversation.
I just want you to listen to me, and I'll be able to talk to you in person when I see you tomorrow.
Okay.
Because I don't know what's going on, but my mom walked the kids. I only heard part of the story, and I'm going to go down there and talk to her tomorrow to find out what's going on.
Okay.
She didn't want to elaborate, but she said that someone approached her on the street, called her by name, handed her an envelope with something in it.
Yeah.
And somebody was, she really wouldn't go into detail, and was, I have no idea what this is in reference to. Something regarding her son, something regarding his ex-girlfriend, and the person asking my mom for some money.
What?
Yeah. So I said, I'm like, first thing she was saying, I thought it was like something involved in the IRS or a patient or something like that. So I don't even know what the fuck it's about at all. Right. Well,
did she see the person? Was she like, she should have
I said, that's what I said. I said, someone's going to try to blackmail you or something.
Exactly.
Right.
You're like that.
I said, you got to go straight to the police. So she's like, I don't even know what this is about. I don't want to talk about it. I go, well, take a picture and send me what it is. She's like, I just want you to see it in person. So I'm going to go there. I can't even fucking go there today because I won't get out of work until 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So she's like, just come down.
Was Lewis stalking your mom?
I don't even fucking know. I don't know what's going on, what my mom's about. I mean, you didn't do anything with my mom. I mean, yes.
I don't know what to do with my mom.
Okay. Just checking. I don't know.
Charlie says in the recording that his mom has the day off tomorrow, And so he's going to go down to her house and talk to her then. About an hour and a half later, Catherine calls Charlie and asks if everything is okay. Charlie tells her that he hasn't heard anything since he last spoke with her. They again talk about what happened, and Catherine says his mom must be freaking out. She asks if he's going to call the police, and Charlie says he wants to talk to his mom first. He says she's shaken up. Charlie says he thought his mom told him that the person had mentioned Catherine's name, but he's not sure. Catherine tells him that maybe he has a crazy ex-girlfriend, that it can't be her. The next morning, Agent Sanford said that Charlie went to his parents' condo and met with his mom. Charlie and Donna ended up going out behind the condo on a walkway behind a restaurant on the water. Two people from the FBI's surveillance team wore recording equipment and tried to get close to them to record, but Charlie and Donna sat by themselves, away and by the water. Agent Sanford said their demeanor was very cautious, looking around a lot, leaning in close and talking to each other, even whispering. At 3:14 p.m., after that meeting, Charlie calls Catherine. They talk about meeting up, and then they do meet up outside of where Catherine was currently working at a place called Optimar Realty. At about 4 p.m., they first met in Charlie's car, and then they went into a restaurant called Dolce Vita. Agent Sanford said they tried to record their conversation, but that it was very hard to hear. The next morning, at 8:17 a.m., Catherine calls Sigfredo. They're arguing about something, and he says, "I have a more pressing matter I have to attend to." Catherine tells him that she doesn't feel secure and that she's on edge. They continue to argue back and forth.
I'm gonna take care of my fuck. I'm gonna take care of this fucking problem. I'm gonna take care of this fucking problem.
And then, what are you gonna take care of? That's why you don't discuss anything with me. You're not even listening.
Because the less you know, the better off, man.
No, you're making
stop, man. Just stop talking on the phone, man. Bye.
That's why you can't even do anything.
About 15 minutes later, Catherine calls Sigfredo again. Now listen closely. In the call, it appears as though Catherine is telling him that she needs him to pay for their son's school. She keeps saying she isn't sure of the exact amount, but that it's on a piece of paper she gave to him. But after the clip is played in court, Prosecutor Kappelman points out that the last four digits of the phone number belonging to the undercover agent that was on that piece of paper was 6570.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yes.
I don't remember if it was, I think just in case, I think like you have to pay for Ethan's food because like, the balance is $65.70.
I have to pay for it?
Like, I think, you remember, like I wrote it down, the amount that you're supposed to put?
You can't pay for it?
But I'm not sure if it's $60.57 or $65.70.
I'm trying to get a secured credit card. Is there any way you could pay for it?
I'm just telling you, I don't remember if it's either one of those numbers.
Well, you're picking them up today, so...
Huh? The what?
You're picking them up today, so you'll find out when you get there.
The amount that I gave you on a piece of paper... I don't know if it's $60.57 or $65.70.
Sorry.
4 days later, on April 24th, Charlie calls Catherine and they discuss meeting up. She's driving to where he is, and she asks him if she can call him through WhatsApp, and he said he will turn his ringer on. Catherine and Charlie meet, but Agent Sanford said they were not able to surveil that meeting. He said Catherine and Charlie had mentioned WhatsApp, an encrypted and private communication app, on their phone call, and so the agents didn't know about the meeting until the last minute. Agent Sanford said that at this point, no one had called the number that the undercover agent had given to Donna on the paper, and so the next step in their bump was to send a letter to Donna and Harvey's condo. The letter referenced Tato, the nickname for Luis Rivera. It read, "My phone is not ringing, so you don't care about Tato and what he did for you. He knows he is fucked, and soon so will you." At 4:33 p.m. on April 26th, Catherine calls Charlie and says she knows he told her something about a client, but that she got the number mixed up. She says she's been calling both numbers, but that no one is picking up.
I'm calling both numbers, but nobody's picking up, so I need to figure out, because, or else I could set up, you know, with the realtor to show the property.
Oh, fuck. It sounds like a really good client if they're going to rent the place. I actually have the number at home.
Okay, but it's high enough, like, I need it, like, that.
Well, I can... Fuck, I wish I would
like,
remember
I'm so stupid. It's the thing is like, I tried to, you know, remember it, and, like, I just couldn't. Like, I've been calling so many people today, so it's, like...
I'm going to be home in probably 2 hours, and I can get you the number then. Hopefully they haven't, like, looked at other properties yet.
There's no way at all you can get the numbers from.
Let me...
Before I get out of work?
Well, let me do this. Let me see if I can get the number. I got the number at home in my desk.
Okay.
But let me see if the number may be some other place, okay?
Okay.
All right, I'll call you right back.
Charlie then calls his mother, Donna, and asks her if she knows the number that was written on the paper the other day. She says she doesn't, and he tells her that someone just called him asking for it because they thought they remembered it, but evidently they remembered it wrong. He said he has the paper at his house, so not to worry about it. He asks her if she wrote the number down, and she says no. They then hang up, and Charlie immediately calls Catherine back. He tells her that he can't get her the number until he gets home, but that he should be able to get it to her in about 30 minutes. At 5:35 p.m., Sigfredo calls Catherine. She tells him that she thinks she remembers the listing for one of the properties. Although they're talking about listings, she gives him the number for the undercover agent.
I think I remember that. Remember one of the listings that I had to tell you? One of the properties?
Yeah.
What was that? I don't know, just in case that you call, you know, because I have to set it up.
Yeah, I tried to meet the listings each time.
Okay, it's I believe it's 305.
Okay.
712.
Okay.
6570.
The next day, Donna calls Charlie. He tells her that everything is being taken care of.
Literally, everything else is being taken care of.
Great.
Just so you know, they actually called the person, and nobody picked up.
Really?
Yeah.
They would have these throwaway phones, maybe.
Well, that doesn't matter. I mean, it's totally nothing as far as voicemail. But no one picked up. They tried a couple times. I wouldn't worry at... Let me tell you something. I would not worry at all. I'd worry about other things. Trust me when I tell you, Mom. It is... You've done nothing wrong.
Yeah.
And it's because of that you have nothing. Literally nothing to worry about. Someone's fishing and someone wants to try to make some money because they're struggling. But that will never amount to anything. So someone's just trying to throw something, you know, throw a fishing line out there and say, how you doing? Throw a fishing line out there and see if they can catch something. And I understand why they're doing it. I understand what they're trying to do. But I mean, it doesn't make it right. And I wouldn't worry about it at all.
Agent Sanford said that still, at this point, no one has actually called the phone number, despite Catherine telling Charlie that they have. So the next day, on April 28th, the undercover agent decides to call the Adelson Institute and asks to speak with Donna. The agent tells the receptionist that his name is Sammy and that he had given Donna some very important documents the prior week and still hasn't heard from her. After this call, Charlie and Donna speak on the phone again. Donna tells him about the call, and Charlie said he'll call someone to take care of it and that she shouldn't worry at all. A few minutes later, Charlie calls Catherine but doesn't get through. He calls again and leaves her a voicemail, telling her it's important and to call him. Charlie then tries to call her again, at least two more times, but it goes to voicemail. At 10:43 a.m., Catherine calls Charlie back. He tells her how a guy named Sammy called his dad's office. Catherine calls it a bullshit game.
So they're not coming out on foot. They're not writing letters and they're not calling the office because they have nothing better to do.
Well, I don't know what to tell you because I called that number myself.
Okay. Well, let's call that number again to find out what the fuck's going on.
And nobody picks up. And even tried another number and left a message.
Okay. Well, I would...
I'm trying to get whoever's threatening your family and helping you guys out and trying to help you guys out, but it's like, if they don't pick up, like, what the fuck?
I understand.
It's like, it's a fucking joke.
I understand that they fucking called this morning and they're waiting for the phone call. That's what I'm telling you. And since it's three times...
Get the number or whatever that is that's calling you. Or
305. Or whatever it is. 6570. You have the number.
Exactly. That number is obviously, it's like a non-working number.
Okay, can you find out? Okay, find out who the fuck it is. Because the other phone call is going to be the FBI. I'm telling you. And then when they do catch the person, they're going to be asking him lots of questions about who Katie is.
We already spoke about this. It's like not even like a fucking joke anymore. Because
it's not a fucking joke,
it's like
Katie.
Somebody's harassing you guys. If somebody's harassing and using my name, and it's like,
okay.
You
so
die
like that? Okay. Think it through. Find out who the fuck it is. That's all I'm asking you.
Catherine tells him it's fucking bullshit and said she's about to go to the FBI. She then says it probably is the FBI. They continue to argue back and forth. Charlie tells her he's going to call the number, and then he does.
Hello, you guys. Who is this? Who's this? Someone's been calling my family and trying to figure out who this is.
In reference to what, man?
Someone by the name of Sammy called?
Yeah, that's me, man.
What's going on?
Well, what's going on is my brother Tato. Okay, my brother Tato has not been taken care of. His family's not been taken care of. I talked to a dentist. Why are you calling me? Who are you? I gave the number to a lady.
I don't know Tato.
You don't know Tato?
No.
I'm sure you know Katie and Tuto. They've been taken care of since the family problem been taken care of up north.
I don't know who you are.
After the agent continues to threaten him and tell him that Tato needs to be taken care of, Charlie says he's never met these people, but he's going to look into things and call him back. He then gets on the phone with Catherine again and tells her what happened when he called. He tells her that at one point the guy said, "Do the right thing," which makes him sound like a cop. Catherine and Sigfredo then talk. And Catherine tells him what happened. She doesn't mention Charlie by name, only calls him that person. Catherine and Charlie talk again a few more times about it. Charlie says it could be someone reading the newspaper and playing games, but they need to stop, he says. Charlie says he feels better about it, but Catherine says she's on edge and wants to punch someone in the face. Before the prosecution rested their case, they recalled Investigator Isom to the stand. He told the jury that in his interview with Wendy, she had told him that on the morning of the murder, she had driven down the street and had seen the crime scene tape that day. He testified that from where she said she had been, she wouldn't have been able to see that. Investigator Isom also testified that at the time of Catherine's arrest, he received a phone call from Charlie's attorney, but he wasn't allowed to say in court what was said. Sigfredo's defense team called a Florida Highway Patrol sergeant to the stand, who said he pulled over a 2011 Hyundai at 9:12 a.m. on June 4th, 2014. He said the driver was Luis Rivera and that he does not recall a passenger in the car with him. He said he would have noted that in the citation he issued and didn't. Sigfredo's defense also called John Sawacki, an expert in cell phone analysis, to the stand. John testified that more than half of Charlie's text messages did not appear in his iCloud account. He couldn't say for sure whether they had been deleted, but said they weren't captured. He also told the court that Charlie had other messaging apps on his phone, and that it was possible that Charlie did communicate with Lewis using one of those apps, that he had no way of excluding that. Catherine's defense attorneys recalled some of the investigators in the case to the stand too. One investigator agreed that there was a phone contact that both Charlie and Sigfredo had in common, and that was the number of a local mechanic. Another investigator agreed that the morning after the murder, Catherine's path of travel could also be consistent with her driving from her brother's house to Yindra's house to pick up her kids, as opposed to from Charlie's house to Lewis's house to drop off the money. He said he couldn't say for sure one way or another. The last witness they called was Catherine Magbanawa. She testified that she used to work for a liquor company that would pay her to hand out samples and get feedback. She said she was paid in tips. She also used to work at a couple clubs where she would make cash too. And in addition to all of that, she said her mom and Sigfredo would also give her cash. She said Sigfredo did not like Charlie or the fact that she was dating him, and she described a day when Sigfredo confronted her and Charlie while they were driving. Sigfredo cut them off, got out of his car, and started screaming at them in the middle of the street. She said Charlie was freaking out, but that they were able to drive away. She denied having any involvement in the murder and denied ever delivering money to Sigfredo or Lewis. She said she didn't even know about the murder, that Charlie had only ever told her that his brother-in-law had been in an accident. She told the jury that she had asked Charlie for a favor, if she could start working for him.
Why were you asking Charlie Adelson to help you with employment? Explain to the jury.
The primary reason of why, for I needed insurance for my children, and in order for me to get insurance for them, you kind of have to be in some type of bracket where you're making X amount of money so that I can get insurance.
So just to clarify, who were you seeking? Is this insurance that you were trying to get from the state of Florida for your two children?
Yes, ma'am.
She agreed that by doing that, she was defrauding the Department of Children and Family Services. She told the court that she worked for Charlie, not at the Adelson Institute.
Basically, since he was doing me this favor, I was kind of like his assistant. If he needed any help with like of a patient or something was, or, you know, he needed help with, I would help him with that. And he had like rental places too. So I spoke to him about that too.
When you say rental places, what do you mean?
He owned a couple properties and then he needed to collect from the tenants in that place or try to find out if everything is up to par in that building or complex.
Would you be responsible for collecting rent or...
Initially, he wanted me to try to collect rent, but those tenants were so difficult, so I just didn't do it.
So you weren't working steady hours for the Adelsons?
No, ma'am.
She received checks until 2016, until right around the time Sigfredo got arrested. Catherine was asked about her breast implants and how she paid for them. She said she had used her cash tips that she had saved up, and that when you pay in cash, you get a discount. As for the Lexus, she said in April 2015, she got into a car accident in her Mazda. She asked Charlie if she could borrow the Lexus. She then bought it from him for $1,700 in cash. She testified that after she and Sigfredo got back together in May 2015, she didn't tell him that she was still talking to Charlie and was working for him. She said he would be very angry, so she kept that from him. When Charlie called her about the man approaching his mom on the street, she said she was confused. She had no idea what was going on. When they met up at a restaurant the next day called Dolce Vita, she said Charlie never showed her the piece of paper the man had given to his mom.
What, to the best of your recollection, was he telling you at that table? I know he talks a lot.
Yes. He said, I know he mentioned about somebody approaching his mother. I don't know if he said girlfriend or specifically said my name at that time, because I don't remember that day that clearly. But, I mean, that's about it. He just started going off on scenarios and I kind of just lost them.
Did he mention anything to you about a homicide out of Tallahassee?
No, ma'am.
Did he mention anything about his ex-brother-in-law being murdered?
No, ma'am.
He kept that from you?
Yes, ma'am.
Did he ask you to do anything for him?
He asked if I can call that number.
Did he explain to you why he wanted you to call it?
Because I believe they said ex-girlfriend or my name.
Did he ever explain to you why he didn't want to call it?
No.
Did you ask?
No.
She told the jury that Charlie talks and talks, and she would just sit there and listen, but that half the time she doesn't pay attention to what he says. She testified that she doesn't think she told Sigfredo who specifically was being threatened, but at some point she said he did know that it was Charlie's mom. She said he was angry that she was still talking to Charlie. She was asked about when Sigfredo said, "The less you know, the better," on one of the wiretapped phone calls. She said she didn't know what he meant by that. She admitted that she had never called the number, even though she told Charlie she had. She said she had asked Sigfredo to call the number. He's the father of her kids, and if she needed something, she would always ask him. She told the court that she was getting frustrated with all of Charlie's phone calls about the extortion. She said he was losing it. She called Charlie a paranoid person and a know-it-all. Her attorney then asked if they were talking in code in the call where she says she got the number mixed up for the possible client who was looking at a property.
Were you talking about real estate ventures, if you remember?
For that specific phone call, I might not have been.
Is it possible that you were talking in code?
Probably.
Why would you be talking in code about real estate stuff?
I was probably next to Yandra at work.
And where does Yandra work?
In realty.
In a realty office.
Mm-hmm.
On the day Sigfredo got arrested, police came to her home and were banging on her door. She didn't know they were the police. She just saw two figures outside in civilian clothes. She then called Sigfredo at work. He told her that the feds were there. She said Sigfredo told her that he didn't know why the feds were looking for him.
Did you know that this had anything to do with anything in Tallahassee?
I think he said on the phone, like, they asked him about Tallahassee, and I was like, well, what about Tallahassee, you know? Well, why would they ask you about Tallahassee, basically?
After Sigfredo was arrested, she said the news was everywhere. She said she shut down and didn't want to talk to anyone or hear about anything. She was able to read the arrest warrant online, and then another document was leaked to the media, which told her that she was a suspect too. As for whether she thinks Charlie is involved in the murder, she said yes.
There are televisions in jail, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you were privy to several news reports on this case, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You were aware that the government's position was that you saw a news report where they said that you hold the key to your own freedom. Remember
yes, ma'am.
That?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. What did that mean to you?
Objection, relevance.
Overruled.
That it's up to me to get out of jail.
Okay, and how would you do that?
If I gave up Charlie.
Do you have information that Charlie Adelson was involved in this?
Do I have information? I mean, based on everything that we've been seeing, but I don't have personal information.
Based on everything you've seen, do you think Charlie was involved in this?
Yes.
Do you think Charlie was lying to you?
Yes.
Are you innocent? Her attorney asked her. Yes, she replied. On cross-examination, Prosecutor Kappelman pointed out that Sigfredo may not do anything for Charlie, but that he would for Catherine.
But he wouldn't do anything for Charlie Adelson, right?
No.
Because he hated Charlie Adelson.
He hated him.
But he would do anything for you, wouldn't he?
No, because sometimes I ask him simple tasks and he can't even do that.
He loved you, didn't he?
I believe so.
He was desperate to get you back. We've heard a lot of evidence about that, haven't we?
Yes, ma'am.
What about for $100,000? Would he do things for that?
No, ma'am.
She was asked if she took Sigfredo to the rental car place, and she said no.
And you didn't take him to the rental car place?
No, ma'am.
Why do your phone records put you there, that time frame?
It was around other businesses. I don't recall what I did that day.
You don't recall what you did that day, but you know you didn't go to that rental car place, right?
Yeah, no.
That you do remember.
Yes, ma'am.
She acknowledged that at some point, Charlie gave her the number of the undercover agent, but she doesn't remember exactly when. She also said she doesn't remember Charlie ever giving her any cash, paying for a credit card bill, paying for her breast augmentation, teeth whitening, or paying for her car repairs. But she does recall him paying for her and the kids to visit Sigfredo's mother in Santo Domingo. She was asked about why she asked Sigfredo to call the number of the undercover agent.
And you were actually trying to get Mr. Garcia to call that number, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And did you tell Mr. Garcia that you were trying to get him to call a number for Mr. Adelson?
No, ma'am.
All right. And you testified on direct that the reason you went to Mr. Garcia for assistance is not because he had something to do with this murder, but because he's your child's father and that's who you go to when you have a problem, right?
Well, at that specific time, yes.
All right. And that's why you solicited him to commit this murder, right?
No, ma'am.
And he's the person you go to when you have a problem.
Thank you. You would insinuate that, yes, but that's your opinion.
No,
that's
not what happened. Is that a person you go to when you have a problem?
Yes, ma'am.
You didn't ask Mr. Garcia to help this lady get her kids back in Tallahassee?
No, ma'am.
You didn't solicit him to commit a murder of Dan Markell?
No, ma'am.
Prosecutor Kappelman then grilled her about her job at the Adelson Institute. She said she was Charlie's personal assistant and that she wouldn't go into the office. At one point, on a wiretapped phone call, she and Charlie referenced her going into the office on weekends. She said he would want her to go there and clean, but that she never did. As for whether she ever signed into their computer program, she said she believed she did it a few times, but couldn't recall what she did.
And what type of work did you do when you logged into Adventrix?
Well, I was just looking at the patients, like the scheduling.
Okay. And did you schedule any patients?
No, I didn't schedule anything.
Are there any patients we could call that could verify that they've ever had any contact with you?
Not that I can recall, no.
Did you ever go to the office on the weekends for any purpose?
I believe I have, like probably, but not often, like once or twice only.
Okay. And what was the purpose of that?
He wanted me to clean up in the office.
Oh,
I probably just stopped by at the office. Don't quite recall what I did. It's been a couple of years.
All right.
But I have stopped at the office before.
On the same day law enforcement came to her residence, she admitted that she went with Sigfredo to Walmart and that he purchased burner phones for both of them. She said she never stopped using her original phone, though. When asked why she was talking in code on the wiretapped calls, she said she was either at work or around her kids.
Okay, and what does the code mean? What's it code for?
What is the code for what?
Why do you need a code?
I mean, because he's talking about somebody, you know, that specific number.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was talking about, you know, like trying to find out who is trying to contact his mom or trying to extort money from his mom. So every time that I would speak to him, I would just talk to, if like Yindra's next to me, I'm not going to tell him like, oh, remember what we were talking about or whatever. And my conversation wasn't going to be like that around other people.
All right. So, for example, when you spoke to Mr. Garcia, You told him that Ethan's clothes would cost $65.70. Do you remember that?
Yes, ma'am.
And 6570 was the last four digits of that phone number, right?
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
And so was this an example of the type of code that you used?
I guess.
And are you telling this jury that that was needed to protect your children or your coworkers in some way?
Well, yeah, because I'm not disclosing any numbers around anybody else. Okay. Not saying a phone number out loud.
On redirect, Catherine said she hasn't talked to Charlie since their last recorded phone call in 2016. She was asked if the Adelsons could ever pay her any amount of money to keep her silent and to keep her away from her children for so long, and she said never.
There has been no promises made to you of money in order for your testimony today, right?
No, ma'am.
In fact, you also just testified that you think Charlie Adelson is behind this.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Could they pay you any amount of money to keep you away from your children?
Never.
And you have been aware from the beginning who they want?
Yes, ma'am.
Why won't you just lie and tell them that Charlie was a part of this?
I wish I could, because I wouldn't be incarcerated, and I'd be free, and I'd be with my children.
And why haven't you done that?
Because I'm telling the truth.
The jury found Sigfredo Garcia guilty of conspiracy and murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison. They were deadlocked in regards to Catherine's involvement, and a mistrial for her was declared. Catherine's retrial has been scheduled for April 2020. No other arrests have since been made. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you believe the prosecution's theory that the Adelsons hired Catherine, who then hired Sigfredo, who then hired Lewis? Did you find Wendy's testimony credible? Did you find Lewis's testimony credible? And Catherine's? Do you think more arrests will be made in this case? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.